Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James. This is Pete.
G'day, everyone.
It is April the 27th, and it is episode, hang on, I'll just check here, 57. So there's a bit of mirroring there. We've got a huge show for you guys today. We're going to be talking to IPA Policy Director Simon Breeny. We're going to be talking some Royal Banking, the Royal Commission into the banks, his appearance before a Senate committee hearing, and some other fun stuff. We're also going to be talking to Tim Andrews about the upcoming Friedman Conference in Sydney. That's a really fun conference. You guys got to get your tickets. So we'll be talking to Tim about speakers that he's got coming. And
from the Australian Taxpayers Alliance.
Absolutely. Yep. That's where Tim's from. And there's speakers from all over the world. So we'll be talking to him about that. Now, I know I said there were only, I've been saying for weeks, there were only three Robert Toombs clips. And haters will say that I should check my emails a bit more closely, and when it was clearly told to me that there were four. But that's a rumor. But there is going to be a fourth Toombs clip.
Really?
Apologies.
I didn't know that.
So it wasn't an end then.
Yeah. Well, maybe we could, this would be like bonus sneak peek. Oh, but it's not really a sneak.
You should have sold that.
Peek. It's a peek.
Yeah. Just because you guys have been good. You've been good podcast listeners.
A bonus track.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, the hidden track at the end of an album. So that's going to be also on the show. Joined as always by illustrious presser of the buttons, Nina Lowenarthan. Nina, how are we feeling?
Good, thank you.
How do you feel about illustrious? That's pretty good.
I don't know. What?
Think about it. We'll get back to it.
Have a bit of a think while Pete and I run through the main stories that have happened this week. So, Pete, talk to us about the RC into the banks.
Yep, no worries. So we've been having a Royal Commission here in Australia into the banking, in case you've missed it, over the last sort of week or so. And there's been a number of things that have come out of it. For example, financial planners flogging their own bank's products that are not as good for the client as other banks' products. Oh my God, can't believe that happened. And banks doing dodgy stuff like charging dead people interest.
Yeah.
So,
which is not great, to be honest.
No, it's not. There's the banks.
Like almost little grave robbing there.
Yeah. It is. Well, yeah. I mean, the financial sector appears to be a little bit dodgy based on this Royal Commission. Of course, John Roskam spoke about the Royal Commission of Banking on Q&A.
Yes, and we will play for that clip right now.
The public are absolutely entitled to be angry, frustrated, hurt and disappointed. But we have to understand that in a free market, companies that rip off their customers, that lie to the regulators, don't survive. They're not sustainable. ASIC has 6,000 pages of laws that it is administering. If we are going to have a Royal Commission, we should focus on the underlying root causes. And from my perspective, it's about the government. We now have banks and wealth management companies that are basically guaranteed profits by the government through compulsory superannuation. We have a government guarantee that means banks can't fail. We have the so-called four pillars policy, which means bad banks can't be taken over. From my perspective, we have a Soviet-like system of financial wealth advisory services, and this is not surprising. If we are going to empower customers, then we need a system whereby we understand our own superannuation, and I would argue not many Australians do. We need companies that are more focused on customers and their clients rather than focused on gaming the system, that is the government. We need a cultural change at the very highest level of companies because we have seen massive corporate failures of lying, exactly as Andrew said, customers being charged for services they haven't been gotten, they haven't been served. So this has to be a much bigger discussion about financial services and about us as customers. And for me, the focus has to be as much on the failure of government as it is on the failure of boards.
So that, of course, was RPA Executive Director John Roskam. If you want to see everything John said on Q&A on Monday night, it is on the RPA YouTube page.
Yep, absolutely. The only things worthy he said on that program in years, I reckon.
Everything he said and nothing anyone else said.
Yeah, so that's the best selling we can do for that.
It was
that's some pretty good selling.
The edition was called...
You go.
Sorry, the edition was called Class and Inequality. Thank God the left are finally talking about class and inequality. There's heaps of new and amazing ideas.
Absolutely, yeah. So the only parts of that show worth watching, as you would expect, were John. Mm-hmm. So we've gone to the effort of making sure that's only the parts you see. I want to say, like, another thing I want to say about the banking inquiry is one story that broke, which was pretty funny, was like, I think it was NAB, but 19 of the 20 pieces of advice they gave out were good, meaning 1 in 20 were bad.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like, they knew 1 in 20 pieces of advice were bad.
5%?
Yeah. I would kill for a 95% hit rate of good ideas.
Of like, not 5% hit rate of anything.
If I could get I'm currently at 25%, I reckon. If I could boost that up to 95%, where would my life be?
Depends what time of day or week, time of the week. 2 a.m., you're like nowhere, 9%.
2%.
2 a.m. Sunday morning.
Yeah. That's not to defend NAB for giving out shoddy advice, but I'm just like,
yeah.
Boy, that's a sweet percentage of good ideas.
That's a tough ask.
Cool. So we'll move on. Another story.
We talk more about that with Simon in greater detail.
We do. And some actual serious analysis rather than me just wondering, us comparing the banks to us at 2 a.m. on a Sunday. Now, something that is very interesting happening right now. So Kanye West, obviously, everyone will know about that. I don't really need to introduce him, but he's been on a bit of a Twitter storm lately. It started a few days ago when he tweeted, I love the way Candace Owen thinks. She is a right wing, I guess. I don't like describing things as like right wing, left wing. But anyway, so right wing commentator on YouTube. She talks a lot about how, the Democrats aren't exactly the best friend of black people at the moment. And a lot of stuff about self-victimization. Really interesting thinker. You guys should check out her videos.
We've actually asked her to be on the podcast.
So yeah, pending.
That might happen one
pending.
Day.
Pending.
Yeah, it's pending.
So it's just like the Trump interview.
Yeah.
That's also pending.
We're closer with this one.
More realistic. Where was I? So yeah, really interesting thinker. You've got to check out our YouTube videos. They're really cool. So Kanye tweeted out, I love the way Candace Owen thinks. This set off a bit of a storm. Kanye West, traditionally quite left-wing, once accused George Bush of not caring about black people in a telethon about Hurricane Katrina. And he's always been a bit of a friend of the Democrats, but now he's like, I'm an independent thinker. And it's escalated to the point where last night, recording this on Thursday, but anyway, Wednesday night, he started tweeting, he tweeted a picture of himself with the Make America Great Again hat, and said that Trump and he share the same dragon energy. Dragon energy? Babe?
Well, I don't know if I possess it, to be honest.
You definitely don't possess it.
But I don't know.
Nina, do you have dragon energy?
I don't think I have a dragon name, actually.
I think I have a little bit of dragon energy. Anyway, so there's a lot of ways you could take this Kanye thing. Like, obviously, it's pretty cool in and of itself. The world's most, probably the world's biggest musician, I would say, willing to go out on a limb like this and say Trump's got some good points. And that set off a huge Twitter storm. At the start, I was kind of thinking, because Kanye's got a few albums coming out soon. Is this just generating a bit of publicity, get everyone talking about Kanye? Because I think over a million tweets have been sent out about Kanye this week, which is a lot.
Good for Kanye.
Yeah, it's a lot.
This is why Bolt's our social media expert.
I've crunched the numbers.
He's saying it is a lot.
And a million is a high number.
Oh, really?
So that's my data analysis for today. I'm going home early. I thought it was just generating publicity. But now I'm thinking, like, when you start tweeting, I like the way Candace Owen thinks.
Yeah,
like that is a special level of involvement. Like Candace Owens isn't the first YouTube video you watch on this subject.
No,
you have to watch a few other videos to get to Candace Owens.
Yeah, exactly. And she's like a political figure. She's not a mainstream figure.
Yeah, exactly.
In a way that Kanye West would know who she was if he wasn't interested.
Yeah, I was gobsmacked that he knew who Candace Owens was. So now I'm starting to think I'm still not at so Scott Adams, obviously the guy that comes up with Dilbert, really cool thinker about like persuasion dialogue, and he called Trump.
You guys like him more than me.
I'm saying like I'm not with him that this is like the cultural schism moment, like friend of the podcast and deeply troubled fellow Morgan Begg is.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are saying like this is it, this is a crumbling of the left, Kanye West tweeted. To which I'd say, aren't you the same guys that say a celebrity should stay out of politics? But it's still an interesting thing.
Well, and he also tweeted about Obama, and he said that, Chicago hasn't changed in the 8 years that Obama was in power.
Yeah.
So he, this was a series of tweets where he was kind of, making a stand.
Yeah.
The thing I like about it is, who cares what a rock star thinks, but it's just good to see a rock star being a rock star.
Yeah.
And saying something that's like controversial and, people hating on him and, this is like the good old days.
Yeah, it's like...
Matt Stone.
Seriously, like Matt Stone and Trey Parker, the guys who came up with South Park, were at a conference a few weeks ago, and they say the only way to be punk anymore is to be Republican.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's the only counterculture that is there now.
So, yeah, it's countercultural, that's what it was.
Yes. Speaking of countercultural, this guy is pretty countercultural. Count Dankula, obviously we talked about this in a few podcasts ago. So for people that are new to the show or don't know who Count Dankula is, so he's a YouTube user in Scotland. He's a professional sort of troll. He's pretty open about that. He likes to describe himself as that. Mm. Now, he filmed his dog giving Nazi salutes. His girlfriend's dog.
To annoy his girlfriend.
To annoy his girlfriend who thought the dog was the cutest thing in the world, started trying to teach the dog how to do Nazi salutes. Not the funniest thing in the world.
No,
didn't really crack a smile on my dial, but certainly didn't need to go to court for like hate speech, which is what happened. And the update for this week is his sentence came down. He has to pay £800 for making a video.
Hmm.
That is pretty bad.
As you say, I don't like him as a person based on what he's done, but £800 because teaching your dog to do Nazi salutes.
That's a hefty fee.
It is. It is. And exchange rate as well when you think about it.
I don't think he has to think about it.
He doesn't.
We have to think about it.
For the listeners.
He's not sitting there going, God, an Australian dollars. What is that?
He's like, gee, a pound is heaps.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
And, you know, Scotland's economy.
I'm hoping he's thinking free speech is dead rather than like how many beers has this set me back?
Count Dankula.
Count Dankula. And then another story that broke this week. So Chelsea Russell is another British person who is fallen afoul of the courts today. This week, she posted lyrics to a song by Detroit rapper Snap Dogg, not to be confused with Snoop Dogg, Snap Dogg, on the bio of her Instagram account to pay tribute to a child who died recently, and his favorite song was this song. Now, this rap song, obviously, pretty offensive lyrics, pretty out there, a lot of references to guns, violence, and drops a few N-words, and she used the lyrics to pay tribute. It sounded like a lot of users were using these lyrics to pay tribute to the kid because the kid loved the song so much. Fallen on deaf ears in the British Parliament, she will also be in a bit of legal hot water for it.
That's right. So she's before, I think, the court in Merseyside. As her defence lawyer pointed out, Jay-Z performed at the Glastonbury Festival a few months ago and just dropped N-words left, right, and centre. So, I mean, is it only a matter of time before someone goes, oh, well, that actually offends me, I'm going to sue Jay-Z?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, is that that's the natural extension?
I mean, it's a good way to meet Jay-Z in court.
Yeah. I feel like, because I thought of that today, I feel like that's where this reaches its end point, and that's the point where everyone actually goes, actually, this is stupid. So hopefully that'll happen.
Yeah. Hopefully.
In my view.
Cool. So that's it for the main stories this week. Yeah. No, Pete's thoughts bubble. It's good to have you actually providing analysis. So we'll move on to our... that really tickled Nina. She's had to lean away
from
the microphone. Nina
laughed and then covered her mouth.
She's still laughing and covering her mouth. Cool. That's it for the stories at the start of this week. We'll now go to our interviews with Simon, Tim Andrews and Professor Robert Toombs. Before we do, we should say thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you guys so much for subscribing. We are available on iTunes, SoundCloud, the IPA website, and you can also now listen through our Hey What Did I Miss email. So whichever way you like to listen to us, whichever way you think your friends would like it to listen to us, keep doing that. And if you are listening to us on iTunes, make sure you're leaving us that 5-star review. Very helpful. Nina, let's talk membership.
Mm. Yes, if you like what we've done and you want
to... You like Pete's analysis.
I like Pete's analysis.
People
that's like one of the random things I like. Anyway, and if you like us, the IPA, of course, and you want to spread the love to everyone, but you're not a member yet, just join us. Click on that join button at the ipa.org.au, and starting as low as $22 per year, you'll be receiving 4 free editions of IPA Review for a year, and also exclusive invitations to events.
Very cool. All right, let's go to those interviews. Okay, we are now joined once again by IPA Policy Director Simon Breeny.
G'day, everyone.
Now, a bit of a slippery fish to get. We've been trying for about 3 weeks. listeners will note last week was Andrew Bushnell called off the bench at the last second.
Yes.
Breeny, now here to face the music. How are you, mate?
Yeah, good. Thanks for having me back on the on the podcast, even though I've rejected your advances now a couple of times.
You know, we're used to it.
Treat them mean, keep them keen. That's the Simon Breeny method.
That's right.
So let's talk pretty big week for politics. Obviously, everyone's talking about the Royal Commission into the banks. So what have you found to be like the best stories from the Royal Commission and the banks, or what are you sort of making of the
thing? Mean, the best in terms of the worst is clearly banks charging people who have deceased for a decade. I mean, getting charged money after you die, you know, it's
rough.
Yeah. So that's clearly the worst. I mean,
and they can't fight back.
Yeah, that's right.
What are they going to do?
So, I mean, I think there's been a lot of shocking revelations that have come through the Royal Commission process. One of the really interesting things, though, is that none of what has been discovered is in fact being discovered, in the sense that we're hearing about it for the first time. In every case, ASIC already knew about it. The other regulators already knew about this conduct. And in some cases, they were already investigating these cases. So I think, you know, a lot of what we have seen is being reported on because it's in the context of the Royal Commission. But, you know, I'm not convinced that the Royal Commission is suddenly worthwhile because we know about all of this stuff that the regulators already knew previously. What we know is that the regulator's been pretty rubbish at enforcing the existing set of regulations. And does that surprise anyone that regulators are doing a bad job? Certainly doesn't surprise me.
So what is your takeout? What do you think should happen and what do you think will happen?
Well, we clearly need more regulations that the regulator won't enforce.
Yeah.
I mean, that's clearly the answer, sarcastic. Right? The obvious answer is what we need is...
He's winking a lot.
we need more than... there are currently 6,000 pages of regulations that ASIC has to administer. What we need is maybe, you know, 7,500 or 8,000.
Okay.
Maybe then they'll start changing culturally internally, and that will mean that they'll enforce those regulations.
Flat 10,000, big round number.
So many people, though, in the context of this debate are talking about that. How can that be your response? This is clearly a cultural problem. It's a cultural problem within the banking sector, and it's a cultural problem of regulators not enforcing the law.
Why don't they enforce it?
Well, it's hard.
It's a difficult thing to do,
I'm sure. But I think there's also a cozy relationship between regulators and banks, and I don't think we should be surprised by that. I mean, if you've got an incredibly complex system which requires the sort of specialisation that only lawyers and like serious compliance experts have to find your way through the myriad of regulations, then should we be surprised that there are deals that go on between banks and the regulators? And should we be surprised that these cozy relationships develop? I'm not. I mean, I think it's a problem of the regulatory state, and the red tape problem that we've got in Australia is, this is one of the effects.
Yeah, I got a note, headline here from the ABC. Regulator ASIC has a culture of subservience to the big banks, says former employee, which floored me. I couldn't believe a close working relationship between banks and the government would mean that there's a bit of a nice relationship.
So I think that's right. And I actually think that the broadly, this is sort of the left's critique. And one of the ideas that's been thrown around is that you should ban people from being able to move into a role at the regulator after they've been at a bank for a period of time, 7 years or whatever. I mean, I guess in a superficial way that might sort of resolve the problem, but they don't understand how deep this is. If that's the solution that you're putting forward, you don't understand how deep this issue is of the coziness that goes on between large corporates and government. It's deep, it's embedded, and the more complex a regulatory environment is, the more likely it is those relationships are going to be there.
So on the flip side, if it was less regulated, you'd actually see better behaviour from banks, you think?
Well, I mean, you'd certainly see people being able to choose a set of products that is different from what the Big Four are offering at the moment. I mean, you basically don't have choice at the moment because of the way that competition is hampered by these increased barriers to entry, which regulations put in place. If you go to one of the Big Four and you're being offered a set of services from them, and there's something about what they've done that makes you unhappy, and you choose to leave that bank and go to another bank, you're being offered exactly the same set of services. You're probably being offered exactly the same set of products. The level of service between them is remarkably similar, and I think culturally they're very similar as well. What would happen if we had less regulation in the financial services industry is that you would see lots of smaller banks start up. You'd certainly still see a lot of big banks because you've got to have scale for some of those things, particularly if your loan book is full of small businesses and relatively small home loans. But I think that there'd be a much more interesting array of products and services offered by a much larger group of companies.
Or you'd see big banks like overseas open up branches in Australia.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. I mean, some of those global banks are massive. You know, HSBC is a bank that's got thousands of branches around the world. I think they've got 70,000 branches around the world. That's more than NAB has employees. So, you know, to lock a bank like that out of the Australian market and to protect NAB, Commonwealth, Westpac and the ANZ in particular from the competition that someone like that could provide and the benefits that that then flows into in terms of consumers, I think is the wrong way to go.
Yeah, we scrapped talking about the Banking Commission last week. I didn't know it was going to be as huge a story as it turned out to be, but I'm annoyed now because I was going to say at the time, it's like, this whole thing is just going to be a media circus ending with more regulations passed that are going to make it even harder for new entrants to come in. So the big four banks are going to be like, well, we certainly got punished and they'll still be there for decades.
Yeah, and the real risk too is that we're probably going to see interest rates increase over the next couple of years. And they may increase by quite a few percentage points. It might end up being 5% in a couple of years' time. And having that occur at the same time as it's being made more difficult for the banks to lend, I think is going to lead to disaster.
Mm. All right, chilling.
Yeah. Well, it could lead to disaster. I don't want to say it.
No, you definitely said it definitely will. Yeah. Simon, the soothsayer.
Edit that out.
No. It's going straight in and we're leading with it. So we'll move on. So you've also appeared before a different committee this week.
Yes, not a Royal Commission
this
week.
Mentally blanking. It's a Senate
committee. Inquiry.
Yeah,
that's
Senate
right.
Inquiry. Could you tell us what that was about?
Yeah, so the Senate Economics References Committee, if you want to get technical, is holding an inquiry at the moment into the Business Council of Australia's commitment regarding several companies wrote a letter to senators saying if the Senate passes the government's tax cuts, which are a 5% reduction for larger companies over the next 10 years, how exciting is that?
Yeah.
5% over 10 years.
Why don't just make it 20 years? Let the party roll longer.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. So they wrote a commitment to the Senate that if those tax cuts were passed that they would employ more people or increase wages. The Senate, in their wisdom, have decided that it's appropriate to pass a motion to hold an inquiry literally into that letter, which I think is one of the weirdest things I've ever seen. And I
that's
made it
crazy.
Clear to senators at this inquiry that I thought it was not only weird, but actually a significant threat to freedom of speech, because if you think that in the course of public debate a statement that you make is going to lead to a Senate inquiry, do you think it's more or less likely that you're going to participate?
Yeah.
I reckon less.
So
that's a really intimidating thing that the Senate has decided to pass a motion to start a Senate Economics Committee inquiry into a letter written to the Senate.
Are they trying to say it's insane? Sort of collusion between...
No, I mean, they're making a political point. It's just a political tool. They're using the Senate inquiry process as a political tool to bash the companies that are coming before them, to give them a grilling, to give themselves some headlines in newspapers. It is all political, and this idea that they're cloaking themselves in, you know, this is an important part of the policy process is nonsense. It's nonsense.
Are they saying you shouldn't be making promises that you're going to hire people?
No. So I think their issue is, I think they're making a political point. I think that's the key point. But if you were to say that they had a serious point to raise, it's that it's an ambiguous claim. It's an ambiguous claim. The letter didn't say every company who is a signatory to this letter is going to increase wages by 10%. And as I said at the inquiry the other day, would that have been more helpful? Yeah, sure. You know, it's going to be much more helpful to the debate and much more likely that we're going to see these tax cuts passed if they make a concrete, rock-solid commitment. But the reality is these decisions are complex, and who knows what a company is going to look like 10 years from now. You know, Qantas looked very, very different even 5 years ago compared to what it looks like today, and that was one of the signatories to this letter. So I
said, ladies and gentlemen.
That's right.
Yeah, we never thought that was going to fall.
Yeah, exactly. You could say mum and dad.
Yeah.
And ooh. They're not going to pass it anyway, so what's the...
Well, no, but this was during the context of the debate that was still ongoing, and they were hoping to get the couple of votes they needed to get the bill across the line.
My thing about the Senate inquiry, so your submission, which I'm quoting from here, the first sentence is, this Senate inquiry is highly questionable.
Yeah, so...
I do like that. It's just like kicking the saloon doors open in an old-timey pub, and everyone's just like, oh, this guy means business.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. Rather than trying to rebut the premise of the question, you're actually rebutting the premise of the entire inquiry.
None of you should be here.
Yeah.
I shouldn't be here.
Which was the point that we were making. You know, there's so many more important things that the Senate Economics Committee should be looking at. And a letter that was written to them when, by the way, other organisations, like, for instance, the Australia Institute, constantly write letters to members of Parliament, and you don't see inquiries being put up by the Labor Party and the Greens when that happens. So, you know, shock, horror, an ideological, political decision has been made in the Senate.
Wow. All right, we'll move on. So the other thing, we've talked about this at the start of the show, but... big thing happening in the US right now. Kanye West
starting to 2024.
Yeah, hit that tweet button.
It's happening.
So
what a bloke.
Like, I don't. There's been a whole lot of Sabine and I have done a different track, but I want to talk to you about this. Like, there's been a whole discussion in the office. Like, this is a cultural moment. I just think it's a thing. Like, I don't really see it as a huge cultural moment. Like, what are you seeing this in the grand scheme of things?
Well, I don't know. I think. You know, being the Nostradamus that I am, we'll see where we are on house prices.
Is this going to be another disaster?
In a few years' time. yeah, exactly. But I think it's significant. I certainly don't think there's nothing to it. I mean, Kanye is one of the biggest cultural icons in the world at the moment, in the West. And certainly if he is willing to put up photos on his Twitter feed where he's got millions and millions of followers... wearing a MAGA hat, a Make America Great Again hat.
Signed.
I think that's significant, particularly when celebrity culture at the moment is overwhelmingly left wing. And to be someone who is a celebrity icon in the way that Kanye is, I mean, potentially there's a good argument for saying that he is the biggest in the world at the moment. I think is really significant.
Mm.
I think it's really cool. I mean, even if nothing significant comes out of it, and you know, at the end of the day, it's
Kanye, he's definitely running for
it's
president.
Kanye West.
Yeah, he's definitely going to run for president.
Well, not according to Kim Kardashian.
Yeah.
Well, I've been reading her. So this is a new thing. This is a new thing for me, right? I mean, a lot of listeners may already follow Kanye and Kim, but this is a pretty new thing for a bloke like me. I now follow. I haven't made the leap yet of following Kim Kardashian. But I do now follow Kanye West on Twitter. So it's sort of, you know, it's like all of these political people and then Kanye.
Yeah.
But I think it's really, really, really interesting whether he runs or not. Who knows?
Yeah,
he's certainly putting a stake in the ground for if he does.
Well, he's been saying it for a while, but you know, he says a lot of things. I did like one of his tweets today was Kim Kardashian, like, my wife just called me to... say that I don't agree with Trump's policies. It's just like the empire is crumbling. Yeah. Kim, get him on the phone.
Yeah. I like it how like he's meant to be like this powerful man, but he still got told off. Just want to clarify, as my missus rightly points out. It's good to see actually a cultural person actually be countercultural.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
Like
totally.
A rock star,
totally.
Not that he's a rock star, but a rock star be. A rock star.
Yeah, it is. It is. And the other really interesting thing that's going to come out of this too is. It's a really interesting thing for people like that to go through the crucible of public debate when they're on the wrong side of things.
Yeah.
When they suddenly find themselves on the wrong side of things, and rather than all of these people saying you're amazing, you've got these people abusing you on Twitter and accusing you of having a mental breakdown. I mean, that was one of the things that they've talked about in the context of Kanye's tweets recently. And Kim, one of Kim's tweets was saying the media is a disgrace for throwing this term around. And they are. I mean, good on her for calling that out. But how significant is it that you've got Kanye being accused of having a mental breakdown and Kim Kardashian, his wife, is saying, you know, this is ridiculous and how bad is the media for throwing this term around?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
I also like how when he tweets stuff like, what is it, truth is my gym and I'd rather a six-pack of truth than something of like a keg of lies. I can't remember what it was. like, that's just, you know, oh, Kanye being Kanye. The second he says Obama didn't change anything in Chicago, it's like, well, it's clearly a mental breakdown.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't think the six-pack of truth?
Yeah, exactly.
He said that him and Trump both have dragon energy.
Yeah. They do. I mean, that's so good. So the other thing that he's been doing is retweeting Scott Adams videos.
Mm.
And one of the things
that were about Kanye West.
That were, yeah.
Full truth.
But I mean, Scott Adams' significant contribution is about communication. And that's one of the things that Morgan Begg here at the IPA pointed out, that there's just such an awesome visual image that immediately pops into your mind when you read the words dragon energy.
Yeah.
Which is so true. So true. It's so effective.
Yeah. Cool. So we've got one more topic we want to discuss. So IPA Review, obviously, you know, our members know what that is. Four times a year we send out the magazine IPA Review. Upcoming one is going to be a really cool article, The 5 Ideas to Transform Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Simon, you have one of these ideas.
Yeah, I do.
This is
so,
a teaser.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The other four, you have to read the magazine.
Yeah, yeah. Very good. So my idea is to massively increase the number of seats in the federal parliament, both in the Senate and the House of Representatives. And I think that it would have a significant benefit because it would essentially, the problem that we've got at the moment is there's a high number of people who are in either the executive, that is the government, so they're ministers or they're parliamentary secretaries, or they're, you know, or they're cabinet ministers or the prime minister, and there are proportionally fewer backbenchers than there are in other systems around the world. So, for instance, the UK. And the US, where there are literally hundreds and hundreds of backbenchers. In Australia, we don't have that yet. You know, let's compare ourselves to the UK, which is the most similar system. Their ministry is about the same size as ours is. So what that means is that when there are debates going on in the public and when there are debates going on in the party room, the backbench has much, much more power, and it's not just up to the executive to exert its will over the entire party room, which is a significant problem in Australia.
Yeah, and also, like, because there's so few backbenchers, every backbencher thinks that they're just a breath away from getting into that executive.
Exactly.
So they're always going to tie the line, whereas like in Britain, you've just got a bunch of politicians are like, never going to happen. I am just going to shoot from the hip.
Yeah.
It's going to be ideological.
Well, I mean, you're going to stand up for your own constituents. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, there's a clear democratic benefit too that comes from having smaller electorates. I mean, how likely is it that you are going to be accurately representing the views of 100,000 people? Yeah. I mean, that's just...
I find it pretty easy.
That's...
Yeah,
I've
got a giant following.
That's a really difficult ask. Unless you,
for most people, like,
unless I can't really represent Bond. Myself.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's hard to represent the views of two people or five people or 10 people, even if you're on the same page. You know, the debates that we have internally at the IPA, where you would have thought ideologically, you know, there's a hair's breadth between us, but there are some pretty serious debates happen.
Yeah, there's some deep divides.
Now, think about that
on the scale. In years.
Think about that on a scale of not 5 or 10 or 20 people, but 100,000.
Yeah.
So I think having much smaller electorates where representatives are representing a smaller number of people is a really sensible, cool democratic reform. But I would say that because that's my idea.
And for listeners out there, there's a really cool YouTube video of my man Jacob Rees-Mogg in the Houses of British Parliament, obviously, taking David Cameron to absolute task, which is something that we are desperately missing in the halls of Australian Federal Parliament. Mm. So yeah, check out that article when it comes out, IPA Review. Also, you can read Simon's submission to that inquiry or committee hearing.
Dan Wild's submission, actually.
Dan
so
Wild's.
Dan and I both appeared before the inquiry, but Dan was the sole author of that.
So it's Dan's submission, but you're at the thing. And then 2 weeks ago, we had Morgan on who had a report, but you got in the paper. Do we have to have a talk about this, Brady?
I'm actually stealing everyone's work. By the way, Pete, I'm stealing a report that you write and will be in the Australian tomorrow.
Yeah, sure. Fair enough. Cool. So we've got more with the Young IPA podcast with James and Simon coming up after this.
It's difficult to see how a democracy can work if people can't understand fundamental concepts. But as you know, I was in favour of Brexit, and I think that that showed that people do value and can understand what democracy is about. But I think there is a danger that we regard politics as purely a transactional business, in which people are encouraged to vote purely in their own interests, and simply in terms of voting for the party that offers the most, that tends to break down any sense of citizenship and common responsibility. I don't think that's happened, but I think it's perhaps a danger. And one danger is that if people are not taught, as you suggested, that this is a system that's had to be created and which has to be maintained. It doesn't exist as a fact of nature. It's something that we've had to make, or the people who live before us have had to make. If people don't understand that these things fit together, that freedom of speech, the rule of law, parliamentary government and so on, these are all part of a single system, and that the system can break down, or it can be neglected. Parts of it can fall off, as it were. If they don't understand that, then it's quite difficult to see what will safeguard a democratic system. Because it's not safeguarded by laws and constitutions, it's essentially safeguarded by the choices of people. And although it may be right to fear populism, though I think the term populism is often simply used to mean democracy when I don't agree with it, the idea that people can be led to vote in ways that are dangerous to democracy itself clearly has happened in certain parts of the world. And if people are not able to find out, or are not encouraged to learn at school or at university or wherever, that this is a system which depends on them and on their choices, then I think there is a danger that populism, or whatever you want to call it, could be a threat to a liberal form of democracy. If people don't understand how the system works, if they don't value institutions, they don't value elections, they don't value popular choices, then the system itself ceases to function. And you could find that an awful lot of things no longer really work. And many of the things that we value as safeguarding our liberties, the things that we do hold dear, we'd find had been undermined and gravely weakened. The fact that many of our institutions are very ancient, and this means not only Parliament, the monarchy and so on, but also everyday institutions, schools, colleges, universities, clubs, societies, all these things are often quite old. And yet, it's also been a society which has been involved in very many fundamental changes, the Industrial Revolution being the obvious one, but also the growth of empire and then the loss of empire. These things are huge changes. And again, if one thinks of many other countries, they have neither this degree of continuity nor even this degree of change. So again, there's this remarkable contradiction. I don't think that antiquity is any longer a guarantee of respect.
No.
And to say that things have been like this for a very long time is no longer seen by most people as a reason for respecting them.
It might be a reason for destroying them. It might be saying they've been around for so long, we need a change.
Yes. So we need to explain them and defend them, if we think they're worth defending. So trial by jury, freedom of the press, these things are no longer regarded as self-evidently respectable because fairly ancient. In the case of the freedom of the press, since the Glorious Revolution. In the case of trial by jury, since the 13th century. But people might say, well, so what? So I think, in a sense, we have to now say, this is why these things are important.
And we have to defend them.
Yes, and we have to help people, make it possible for people to actually know what these things are. A democracy needs understanding. It needs people to know what it is they're voting for. Otherwise, they may simply vote for things that they think will benefit them as individuals. And I don't think a democracy can function for very long on that basis. Otherwise, it becomes, and perhaps our political systems have to some extent become, rather like businesses, with political parties rather like commercial enterprises, and the voter rather like a customer. I'm not sure that democracy, that kind of democracy, has a very glorious future.
Okay, we are now joined for the first time by Executive Director of the Australian Taxpayers Alliance, Tim Andrews. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Now, Tim, with the Australian Taxpayers Alliance and the Australian Libertarian Society, they are getting together to host the 6th Annual Freedmen Conference. Now, tell our listeners what that is if they don't already know and if they somehow don't already have tickets, and then we can talk some speakers.
Massive event.
Absolutely. Massive event. It's the biggest free market centre-right event in the Asia-Pacific region. And, of course, thank you very much to the IPA for your continued and long-standing support and sponsorship of the conference. So we've got about 350 people are expected to come to Sydney in late May to celebrate the ideas that made Australia great, those of small government, individual freedoms, free markets, and to try and have some debates, have stimulating speakers, as well as some really good and fun social events so we can celebrate our beliefs.
Great. Sounds fantastic, Tim. So who are these speakers that are speaking?
Sure. So we've actually got about 80 speakers from around Australia, as well as 12 speakers from around the world. So just some of the speakers we've got, I mean, they come from academia, they come from the media, they come from think tanks, they come from advocacy groups. We've pretty much got a little bit of everything. We've got politicians just to try and, you know, have different points of view. And the important thing is to also stimulate and challenge people and have a little bit of debate. We don't just want to go and hear people who'll agree with us. Like, you go to a conference and you just hear someone who'll say things you've already expected. It gets a bit dull. We want to try and keep things a little bit fresh and fun. And we're even trying a really new thing we're really excited about, which is we've got Toni Morris QC, who I think your readers would know as the barrister who defended the persecuted QUT3. And he's doing a... Sorry, I'm going to list some of the other speakers soon, but I'm just really excited about this one.
No,
do you know the Jeffrey Robertson-style hypotheticals? Have you ever – did you ever watch them back when they were a bit of a thing?
I potentially remember that, but I can't quite, you know, give you a concrete answer there.
So Jeffrey Robinson QC used to run a program in Australia where he'd get about a dozen people from politics, the media, academics, and he'd present a hypothetical situation, which would go for about an hour. And he'd say, you know, this has just happened. How would you respond? You're now the minister in charge of this. What would you do when this news story hits? But it's done in a sort of funny, lighthearted, engaging sort of rapid fire response where you tell a story. It's engaging. It's fun. But more importantly, you can explore difficult moral questions and political issues. And because it's unscripted, you often get a lot more genuine responses from the participants. So Toni Morris QC will be running this, a great champion of liberty who most of your listeners would know of. And he's got this sort of amazing cross-examining style. And we think this is a new thing that we've never tried at our conference before that will really engage the audience. And it's just going to be a lot of fun, but also an interesting and engaging experience.
Sounds awesome. So two of the international acts that I'm really looking forward to seeing are Jeffrey Tucker and Tom Palmer. Now, do you want to give our listeners a bit of an idea of who those people are if they don't already know?
Look, we've got probably two of the greatest champions of liberty alive at the moment in Jeffrey Tucker and Dr. Palmer. Like, Jeffrey Tucker's now with the American Institute of Economic Research. He's the chief liberty officer of Liberty.me. He used to be with the Foundation of Economic Education. He was with the Mackinac Center of Public Policy, promoting Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies. He's author of numerous books, including, and I just love this name so much, Bourbon for Breakfast. And what sort of a name for a book is that?
Awesome. The best kind of name.
And he's just such a fun, engaging speaker. So we've got him as the keynote speaker for the gala dinner. So the gala dinner is probably the highlight of the conference, where we present the Liberty Awards, as well as, you know, have a lot of fun. And Dr. Palmer is now is with the Atlas Network now. He was formerly with the Cato Institute. I mean, he's got a history going back where in the 80s, he started out by illegally smuggling pro-liberty books into the Soviet Union. Like, he risked his liberty, he risked his life almost doing what he thought was right, smuggling books and things and printing abilities into the USSR.
That's so
and he's
cool.
then sprint his yeah he spends his life now going around to some of the most remote regions of the world trying to promote our ideas. I mean, his works for Sydney is pretty remote,
and not a lot of good ideas of liberty around there.
No, it's probably has a better nightlife when he goes to downtown Kabul than Sydney these days. But he actually does go to places like Kabul and, you know, the Middle East and Africa and, you know, all these countries. He organises translations of Bastiat and Mises and all of these books of liberty into different languages. And there's the Atlas Network. I mean, many of your readers would know, it works to try and build free market groups around the world. So, I mean, they're just two of our international speakers, but we're very excited about them. But also Jim Lark, who's an academic in the University of Virginia, but also former chairman of the US Libertarian Party. We've got somebody like, to use another example, a great up-and-coming young person from Serbia, Melissa, who just organized LibertyCon in Belgrade, which is a sort of European conference. I was actually there 2 weeks ago, and she got, you know, over 1,000 young students to attend. I mean, imagine just, you know, getting 1,000 students but interested in our ideas to attend a conference. We've got Ilya Shapiro from there, who's one of the academics at the Cato Institute. John Blanks, also from the Cato Institute, who works in criminal justice reform and I think has had some dealings with the IPA before. Dara Lind from Vox News, who's one of the most sort of insightful contemporary sort of journalists in the United States. So they're just a few of our international speakers there were quite excited about.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. It's going to be a great conference. Where can people go if they want to buy tickets to this?
Sure. So if they want to go and buy tickets, they can, for more information, they can visit www.alsfc.com.au. So they can get all the information about the conference there. They could go, and if they're a student and they can't quite afford it, they can apply for a student scholarship. And we're quite generous due to the support of the Atlas Network with those, and get all the information there.
All right, brilliant. Tim, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Bye.
Okay, thank you to Simon, Professor Robert Toombs, and Tim Andrews for those talks. Very interesting stuff. Cannot wait for that conference.
Triple threat.
Indeed.
Three interviews.
Yep. Thought we were talking about me. But anyway, so we will now go through some stories of Matters of Life this week. We will start off with, let me decide. We'll go with this one. So Pennsylvania State University has a bunch of clubs that love the outdoors. This is the Outing Club.
Outdoorsy types.
Outing Club for the outdoors people.
Yeah.
First time I read that article, I thought it was just a group of people that went around trying to prove that people were gay.
It's probably the time has passed for that club.
It's more of a witch hunt than anything.
It's not what that is.
No, they go outside, they go have fun, they go camping.
Bushwalking, right? Stuff like that.
Exactly. In the Great American Bush.
Yeah.
Scuba Diving Club. So they have now all been, they're not shut down, but they basically can't do any of their activities. The Outing Club can't go outdoors, the Scuba Diving Club can't go underwater as a result of the club not being able to confirm its safety anymore.
Yeah.
And
it's been around for 98 years.
98 years. No complaints recently. Like, no one's died from, you know, the Scuba Club.
Yeah. I think it was, look, we're not going to shut you down, but you can't have any activities that aren't on campus.
Yeah.
So, like, okay, thanks for that.
Well, great.
Walk around the quad.
I'm sure we'll get all the punters coming in to the Scuba Diving Club, knowing full well that they will never scuba without permission.
Yep. So, look, just another example. It's not a freedom of speech thing or anything like that, but just another one example of our campuses, not our campuses, Western campuses becoming worse.
Absolutely. Very sad. Let's move on to a story that makes us laugh.
Maybe. This is better.
Good.
Last Sunday was Earth Day, as you'd all know, and as we like to do.
As you would have known from the ceremonial floats, the week-long celebrations that were there.
Yeah.
Didn't pass with none of us realising.
Yeah, that's right. It's, Morgan Big told us this morning that actually Earth Day was last week, so good old Morgan, the big greenie.
And apparently Earth Hour was 2 months ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've got to have Earth Hour and Earth Day on the same day. That is a terrible organisational effort.
Bit of coordination wouldn't go astray on the environmental front.
Yeah.
But look, what we like to do around this time of year is go through a couple of the, predictions that were made when Earth Day started in 1970. I've got a couple here. And the first one's the best because it's really covers everything. Harvard biologist George Walden, where did we get this from? American Enterprise Institute.
Mm-hmm.
Estimated, and I quote, civilization will end within 15 or 30 years unless immediate action is taken against problems facing mankind. Incorrect. You are wrong. George Ward. And this is why. And this is
Well, let's discuss that because Pennsylvania State University have just shut down all their clubs. So maybe civilization has ended.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe it just not quite long enough. Yeah. It's a bit short with his. Yeah, maybe we'll give George a break. But the thing about him as well is that this is a Harvard biologist, right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter if you're really smart, you still do stupid things.
Yeah.
That's the lesson. And I'm not saying we should do away with higher learning or anything like that, but.
I'm kind of getting that vibe. It wouldn't make your PhD problems a bit. They'd go away if there was no more higher education.
Yeah, there you go.
You wouldn't
have to do
your PhD anymore.
Soon I'll be a doctor, and then I'll be like, oh, you know, I should listen to him. You shouldn't. there's a couple of others. We're in an environmental crisis, which threatens the survival of the nation. That didn't happen. Population will inevitably and completely outstrip whatever small increases in food supply, whatever small increases in food supplies we make. Paul Ehrlich, obviously. He was a massive figure in the environmental movement. The death rate will increase until at least 10 to 100 to 200 million people per year will be starving to death during the next 10 years.
Yeah, 0 for 5, I reckon. I also thought we're going to run out of gold.
That's another one. Yeah, so that's on this list. Click on it. See, hey, what did I miss? Run out of gold, zinc, copper, all these things we haven't run out of.
Yeah, so not a great effort from those people back in 1970.
There's 18 of them.
Yeah.
18 wrong predictions.
But it's good that people aren't. It's good that people are no longer falling for alarmist environmental causes.
That's right.
And, you know, just basically proof right again into the media.
That's the thing about
climate
change.
We've just done away with that.
It's the first time human beings have thought that there's going to be an Armageddon. It's the first time.
Yeah.
It's a really unique historical
event. We're in uncharted territory here. Cool. So here's another one from a university. So this is in Duke University. I think it's in Carolina.
Duke.
Great basketball team. So two dozen student activists crashed an alumni event at Duke University using a megaphone. What? Were you going to do this?
That's right. You do it. You started strongly.
I started strongly, but then I paused. So, anyway. So two dozen student activists crashed an alumni event at Duke University on Saturday. Used a megaphone. They stormed the stage using a megaphone. Drown out the speaker. And apparently it didn't go well.
Yeah.
So a few of the alumni started to get up and, you know, boo them. And a few of them were turning their backs while the demands were being read out, which leads me to think there has got to be no more naked feeling in the world than being in a protest that's going poorly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if you're rushing the stage and getting heckled, that's a naked feeling.
Well, yeah, it is.
I've been on stage and, like,
You've been heckled.
Yeah, I've been heckled. I've been on improv shows that were really, really bad.
Yeah.
But at least everyone in the audience was like, I've come here to see an improv show. Like, they've come here not expecting a protest. Mm. They've suddenly got a protest and it's not even a good one.
Yeah.
You'd be feeling really bad if you're on stage.
And it's not like that it was a conservative event. It was just an alumni event.
Yeah.
It's just the old folk getting together for a few drinks. And,
yeah.
You know.
That's the one you want to crash.
Yeah.
Protesters were really not banking on being heckled by the crowd.
That's right.
They've now said that they were surprised at by the extent of the alumni's negative reactions. And student auger Bryce Cracknell added that crackers to his mates and Pete, added that he was disappointed that the administrators focused more on stopping the students on stage than the angry alumni.
That's right. That was an extraordinary quote. I was going to read that out. How good is that?
Here's the actual quote. Instead of actually going to the alumni and saying that's not appropriate or removing them from the space, they were more worried about us.
I reckon that's because
you're on the stage and with a megaphone.
They're more worried about us, crackers. Are you Dinkum?
I reckon the security would be more worried about the things that they weren't planning on being there than the things that they were definitely planning on being there.
Yeah. You've lost it.
And so now the university's thinking about how to punish these students. Obviously, that's quite embarrassing for a university to have the old alumni, especially as a prestigious university as Duke. There'd be a lot of donor money in the crowd.
Yeah.
So students would be sort of about to be punished. And the students have said they don't deserve to be punished because that is going to, quote, exacerbate mental health conditions and like Bryce said, traumatizing and starting new ones, especially after Saturday's issues, referring to the fall in protest. So you can't punish us because we'd feel sad.
Yeah.
Oh,
I mean, it's a pretty good way of getting out of things.
Skating from Nina. All right. Yeah. So that was.
So now that I've stolen one of yours, you may steal one of mine.
Oh, okay. Well, I actually really liked the goat yoga one.
Yeah, go ahead.
So goat yoga's, but I don't.
Which is actually good because I was 50-50 on it. So
can you jump in when I run out of information? Because it's going to
okay,
be
okay. So what happened was.
So goat yoga was banned in New York, right?
Yes.
Previously been banned in, I'm going to say Boston?
Yeah, somewhere around there.
And it, first of all, I've got a couple of things actually. So goat yoga is yoga with goats.
Yeah.
But I think also.
I mean, you'd think it's over, like, you didn't think goat yoga would be like a special thing, you know? It's like literally just yoga and goats.
Yeah, so people doing yoga.
Unique to the goat.
Not goats doing yoga, people doing yoga in the vicinity of goats. But I think what gets it is because it's also something that they serve beers at.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, the only reason you'd do it. And I think that having animals
the only reason you would do
and
it.
Beer in the same, you know, space, that's the thing that they ban. On that basis, they ban it because it's not hygienic or something.
Yeah, well, and also like, oh, you know, the goats might have stuff on them, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Which means just ban petting zoos. But
Yeah. Animals.
I did like this. Sorry, the new shut down by the New York City Department of Health. Goat yoga is something new to the NYC and therefore uncharted territory when it comes to permit application.
Yeah.
After weeks of communicating and brainstorming. Weeks.
Brainstorming.
Communicating and brainstorming.
What were they brainstorming about?
I don't know. We feel that the concept of goat yoga is just not possible within the laws of the city at this time.
Yeah.
Oh. Weeks of brainstorming. I'm sure there were so many people going, how do we make this legal?
It's a late night.
How do we let people?
They're trying to find different species of goats.
Yeah.
That probably suits the beer.
Maybe sheep or something.
I think their knee jerk was to ban because they're a government and they're trying to save face by saying, well, we tried.
Yeah.
We tried not doing anything, but we thought, no, we should do something.
It's good to see something from the left get banned because, you know, it makes a lot of people realise, oh, you know, this is bad.
Yeah, maybe the government isn't the be all and end all.
But I actually think yoga is right wing.
Ooh, I think that is your scorching hot take.
Yeah,
state your reasons.
It's it encourages you to sort of like your feelings are transient, like they come and go.
And that's right wing,
I reckon. Yeah. Okay. So emotion's not an argument. it's a working theory.
needs a lot of work.
Then you know you don't worry about others. It doesn't have to, we don't have to have equal outcomes. Just you know be in your own mat.
Yep.
And if someone next to you is better at yoga,
right.
Don't be jealous of them. Okay. I don't know. It's working. I'll come
this
back
week,
to it.
This weekend, we're going to a yoga studio and like we're just asking people as they come out, what do you reckon of Trump? Or maybe as they go in, because after like they come out, they'll be very relaxed. We need them at their angriest.
Yeah.
To make sure that I'm right.
And yoga, many rich people do yoga.
Yeah, that's also true. But I'm going to stick with yoga as a left-wing thing. Nina? Tie-breaking vote.
No comment on that.
Oh, Nina, you got to stop sitting on the fence.
Yoga is just yoga. Yoga is just yoga. I did yoga.
Get off that fence,
Nina. We'll continue this going forward.
Cool. So do I... I've forgotten which one's mine and which one's yours. Am I doing Peter?
Yep.
P-E-T-A, not Peter the podcast co-host?
Correct.
You are not in my crosshairs right now, although that could change at any moment.
Peter the Hunger Games. Oops, sorry.
Okay. It's a pop culture reference for any Hunger Games fans out there. I'm not one of them. We had this on the show last year. Peter, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, started to have a bit of a copyright go at a photographer. You guys might know the photographer who put his camera down in Indonesia and then Naruto the monkey picked up the camera and accidentally took a selfie. Maybe purposely. Yeah, don't want to underestimate because it's definitely smiling looking at the camera. Pretty famous photo. If you know, just type in Naruto into Google, you've definitely seen the photo before, even if you don't know it by me describing it out. And so Peter tried to sue that photographer, claiming that Naruto the monkey had copyright issues over that, and because the photographer obviously made a fair bit of money off the sale of that photo.
Went nuts.
We discussed that in the show, talking about Peter just leave things alone. Courts have agreed with us, me and Pete.
Took a long time.
Wish they were with us for a few other offences, but they are with us on this one. They've said that the copyright does, in fact, belong to the human because animals cannot hold copyright.
Yeah. The law doesn't cover monkeys, effectively. You can't have rights. Monkeys don't have rights.
No. Well, yeah, they do have some rights.
It's animal cruelty, I suppose.
Yeah, probably not over copyright of photos of them. I did like this at the end. So the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeal said in its decision, which questioned Peter's motives in bringing the case, quote, Peter seems to employ Naruto as an unwitting pawn in its ideological goals. Huh. You reckon?
Yeah.
Peter is using animals to pursue ideological goals.
Massive. I think at the time when it came out, Peter sort of claimed victory and everyone was like, no, you haven't won yet or anything. Like I think they were just using it as, you know, Peter's had this big victory, but they hadn't had the court case yet.
Yeah.
And I think that was what we said last time. I can't really remember that.
And also, like, any victory for Peter is just one where they get in the media. They had the victory. They were like, what? We have to go to the court?
Yeah. They probably raised coin.
I thought we were done.
They probably raised coin off the appeal.
Absolutely. Now, so we got one last thing, Pete.
Kelly O'Dwyer on Insiders last Sunday.
Had a bad one.
She had a terrible one. It was so they asked her about why the coalition didn't have a banking inquiry earlier, given how it was going, and she really choked. Are we going to play the script?
No, we're going to play a later script. But
oh yeah, so it was just like she just couldn't answer and
or refused to answer.
Refused to answer.
Like, you're probably absolutely stalling. It. Yeah, so you know, there's like 10 questions Barry Cassidy was throwing at her of just like, can we please get a straight answer? All politicians are somewhat good at avoiding questions, but Kelly O'Dwyer really had a bad one.
It's surprising that it was so she went so poorly because, you know, as a politician, you'd absolutely expect to get asked that. And
yeah, she wasn't like, why are there so many questions about the Banking Commission?
And have a reason for...
I mean, to talk about something else.
Just go, oh, yeah, it's because we were doing something else. You know, like...
Yeah. So you can... Well, this is what brings us to this segment, is that Peter and I fancy ourselves as pretty big players in the PR game. Yeah. The media spin doctors.
Are we ever?
So we've got a bit of advice for Kelly O'Dwyer, and we're going to borrow from the world's greatest spin doctor, Michael Wolff, journalist of... What was the book again? Fire and Fury.
Yeah,
Fire and Fury. Always, if you're ever in a tears like that, just pretend you don't know the answer. Pretend you can't hear the question. Michael, tell us how it's done.
And now you say
I'm not getting anything.
You're not hearing me, Mr. Wolf.
I'm not getting anything.
We were hearing each other well just before. You're not hearing me, Mr. Wolf?
Sometimes silence is more powerful than just speech. Don't go.
Michael, can you hear me? No. Never won't be funny. Cool. That is it for the show this week. Thank you to Tim Andrews, Professor Robert Toombs, and Simon Breeny for the interviews. And thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you guys so much for downloading and subscribing. Remember, we are available on iTunes, SoundCloud, our website, and you can now listen through our Hey What Did I Miss email if you are listening to us through iTunes. And also, tell your friends and family, spread the word, talk about the podcast and try and get some more listeners, but always do with them. If you are listening on iTunes, here's a favor you could do for us. You could go to the review section and leave us that sweet, sweet five-star review to help us out with rankings. And Nina, where can people go if they want to become members?
Just visit the website, theipa.org.au, and click on that join button, and starting as low as $22. But yeah, you'll get free four editions of IPA Reviews magazines and also exclusive invitations to our events.
Excellent. All right, see you guys next week.
Stay up.